Hello, I'm Floyd Maxwell, justthinking.com. Welcome to the sixth Floydcast. Well, on today's Floydcast, I'm sort of torn of what to talk about. I haven't made up my mind. Well, in the news this last week, researchers at the South Pole, I mean, it's got everything that you want in an exciting physics story. They're at the South Pole. It's a telescope. Background imaging of cosmic intergalactic polarization, or BICEP 2 telescope. They have detected the first evidence for the primordial B-mode polarization of the cosmic microwave background, or CMB. Doesn't that sound very official? The astronomers claim that the primordial B-mode polarization signal, which is related to primordial gravitational waves that flowed through the early universe, is the first direct evidence for cosmic inflation and has been measured to a statistical certainty of 3 sigma. Probably most people, when they read that, they were like, wow, something big. And then, you know, look at all the check marks. Evidence, cosmic microwave background, inflation, Big Bang, primordial gravitational waves. You know, all the talking points are there, all in one paragraph. Let's go and pop the champagne corks and celebrate. You know, that's probably the average physics reaction. I mean, yeah, there's some skepticism, but the problem with these kind of things, and this was on all the news sources, and they all were saying basically the same thing. Wired had it, and all the physics sites. And my reaction was, I doubt it. And I thought, I wonder how long it's going to take before these first chinks in the armor appear, before the skepticism comes in, and before it's proved to be totally bogus. I just thought to myself, and I thought, I should, you know, make a note and then just see how long does it take. Because I thought, you know, it'll probably take several months before the doubters and the haters kick in. Well, it didn't take several months. It took 1 week. And there's a guy, Neil Turek, cosmologist and Perimeter Institute director, Neil Turek, who worked on an inflationary model of his own with Stephen Hawking in the 90s. Okay, so this is a guy who, past tense, worked on inflation models 24 years ago. And he urges caution and says that extensive experimental confirmation is necessary before these BICEP 2 results can be considered as evidence. Quote, if, and it's a big if, this is true, it would be spectacular evidence. And he said, while he agreed that at first glance the observations are in keeping with inflation, as suggested over 30 years ago, a closer look at the discrepancy between the new results and previous data from the Planck and WMAP telescopes is what worries him, Turek. The tensor to scalar ratio of 0.20 that it measured is considered to be significantly larger than that expected from previous analysis of data. And the BICEP 2 people feel they've got it covered. They said that they believe certain tweaks could be made. So already the guys who came out with the original findings a week later are talking tweaks. No, pardon me, the day of the announcement, yesterday, so this was like a week ago, the day of their announcement, they're talking that they're certain that some tweaks could be made that would make the two results agree. Well, now, Turek kicks in and says, these tweaks would be tremendously ugly. And in fact, I believe that if both Planck and the new results agree, then together they would give substantial evidence against inflation, exclaims Turek, further explaining that we must be careful before we treat them as true. And another guy, astrophysicist Peter Coles, based at the University of Sussex, is also cautious. He says, it seems to me that there's a significant possibility of some of the polarization signal not being cosmological. So basically, he thinks that there could very well be contamination, like earthly contamination, in other words. If it is genuine, then the spectrum is a bit strange. May indicate something added to the normal inflationary recipe. And then he set up a poll on his website for people to vote, and everyone's saying it's too early to say. Turek, some more quotes from him, possible contamination. Turek is saying that, although it's based in the South Pole, where it's sort of a low-noise environment, he lists various places where he thinks contamination could have crept in. They say it wasn't a factor and they ruled it out to a statistical significance of about 2.3 sigma. Turek is unimpressed. He points out that the final 5 sigma discovery that the team claimed needs to be better explained. You know, it's a bunch of numbers, but bottom line is they're saying, you know, we have a valid result, and he's saying, I'm not so sure. Turek then quotes Carl Sagan. Extraordinary claims require extraordinary evidence, and they don't have extraordinary evidence just yet. You know, he says, discrepancies need to be resolved. Something has to give. And he says, I am a humble theorist. With a laugh, he says this. Now the real task is for the experimental community to scan and replicate results. And what happens when they do that? It's like, what, last year or so? They came out with the notion that some physicists had found faster than light speeds from neutrinos. Everyone was all excited about it. And it turned out that it was basically experimentation error. And this is where we're at with physics. First of all, our theories are really embarrassing. The more you look at them, educated critical eye, the more embarrassing our theories are. And I mean the mainstream theories. And which is to say, everyone's theories, because very few people aren't in the mainstream. And the mainstream only has four or five, you know, sort of branches of theories. And they all are coming from the common tree. They're trying to work with what's already there, and then they try and hack stuff. Like the Higgs is an add-on hack to the standard model. And supersymmetry is required for self-consistency of, I think, the standard model. There must be these super particles, and that's why they're supposedly looking for them. With the LHC cannot find what they say it can find. Oh, another thing I heard this last week was they said that they think there are particles smaller than the Higgs. Well, the problem is that the Higgs has been touted as the basic particle, the Higgs system. It's so complicated you can't say a Higgs particle. There's a Higgs field, there's a Higgs boson, there's a Higgs mass. Anyway, they're now saying there are particles smaller than the Higgs. Well, it's kind of like, you know, the Greeks coined the term atom, and then they found out, well, there were things smaller than an atom. You know, protons, neutrons, electrons. And then in the last 100 years, we found out that now there are quarks that are smaller than the protons and neutrons, and, you know, so it goes. Well, the Higgs, you know, so the Higgs is already showing battle scars, to put it mildly. Arguably, that announcement last week was more significant than this bogus inflation, proof of inflation announcement, that the Higgs is not the fundamental particle, and there's something smaller. Well, talk about blowing a hole in the whole theory. If there's something smaller than the Higgs, then this Higgs has no special importance. And again, when you study the Higgs mechanism, and yeah, literally there's a Higgs mechanism. I listened to 2 talks on the Higgs for a total of 2.5 hours. 2 very credible physicists, one of them was Sean Carroll. I forget the other's name offhand, but it might have been Leonard Susskind. It was of his ilk, of his stature. Very thorough, comprehensive, scholarly talks on the Higgs. It shouldn't take an average of an hour plus to explain something. I can explain spring and loop theory in 1 minute. And the cool thing is, my theory works at the smallest and largest levels. And it's self-consistent. And it doesn't need supersymmetry. Doesn't need more than the 3-space, 1-time dimensions. It has the same basic ingredients as E equals mc squared. That famous equation has 3 ingredients, energy, mass, speed of light. If you strip my theory down to 3 numeric quantitative things, that's what spring loop theory is. The springs are the energy. The loops are the matter, the mass, the gravitons, as I also call them. And then the speed of light is how fast those springs bounce, how fast they move back and forth. And that's how you propagate anything through the universe, through our body, through any form of communication, any form of interaction is propagated by these springs of energy hitting against each other. The amazing thing is that everything in my theory is known. Like, they calculate what the background energy of life should be, and they get a very, very large number. Well, then they measure the temperature of space, and they go, it's a very small number. And they can't reconcile these 2 problems. Well, I can, and I do, in my theory. It's pretty simple. Life is nothing but energy. There is no space as we have thought of it. There is energy, and then there is what we think of as mass or matter, which is a different form of energy, a more stabilized, interactive form of energy. And I can use springs as a term. You know, I say that the energy is most easily thought of as springs, because if we just think of a bunch of energy, we sort of don't have a way of quantifying that. What does it mean, Bessel? But when we say spring, we know what a spring does. When you push against the spring, it pushes back. Well, let's take a balloon. If you have a balloon full of air and you push against it, it pushes back. And you say, yeah, molecules of gas and air, helium inside the balloon, when you push, they push back. Well, that's the physical explanation, and it's true for a physical system. Well, when you get into space, it's an energy system. And when you push that energy pushes back, because mass, matter, is energy. It's a form of energy, and Einstein's equation proves that it's a form of energy. And space is just at a higher level. I mean, it's a way higher level, but it's at a higher level of energy. Anyway, it's a little frustrating to watch physics make a fool of itself. That's what physics is doing today. Physics is not innovating. Everyone's doing the same tests, trying to extend the same theories. They're all faced with the same consequences. Everyone admits that it's all broken and there's major problems. There's no reconciliation between, for example, quantum theory and relativity. The field theories and the things they're trying to add to explain gravity, they're all horrendous. The more you look at them, the more horrendous they are. It just shouldn't take an hour and a half to explain something. That's your gut check. That's your guy in the street. You know, Newton dropping an apple. That explained his theory, right? The apple's attracted to the earth. That's what's physically going on there, with him explaining it to his brother. Hey, Bob, watch this. Yeah, everyone knows that apple's going to fall to the ground. Yeah, but the apple is being attracted to the earth. Oh, you could understand Newton and his theory. Relativity said that things were bent, and it was a bit of a more of a stretch, literally. And it took a while. It took 30 years for relativity to take off. Well, it's going to take 30 years or more for the next good theory of physics to take off. And not for any fault of the theory, but for the amazing closed-mindedness of modern physicists. And, you know, I realize I'm basically talking to myself here. The number of physicists is small. The number of people who care about physics is relatively small. The number of people who think they can comprehend it is relatively small. But it doesn't have to be that way. You know, really, you can blame the Discovery Channel, the Universe series, Stephen Hawking and Michio Kaku and Neil deGrasse Tyson. Oh, speaking of the wretched Cosmos series, has anyone been able to watch that and not go, whoa, he's sniffing some pretty strong glue there? I mean, wow. And they're going to go all over the map on that series. And this is what they have to do. They have to keep retreading. The amount of recycling of nonsense is so high in physics. It's ironic that physics, which physicists would say it's pure and it's how things work and sort of you can't fool a physicist kind of thing, and yet they fool themselves every day with nonsense. And this stuff lasts a week. You know, these nonsense things come up. And as usual, right, when the press makes an accusation of someone, it's on the front page, right? And when the retraction comes 2 weeks later, it's like DeLorean. DeLorean got accused of stuff, and he ended up proving that he was innocent or whatever. But that was like on, you know, page 33 in the bottom left corner. It's the same thing that will happen with this physics, and is happening with this physics. Like this guy, Neil Turek. If I see him appear anywhere else, I'll let you know, but I doubt it. He's bringing up reasonable caution and skepticism based on math, based on science, based on him researching this very subject and finding anomalies. And you get these guys already, in the day of their announcement, talking about tweaks. Physics is nothing but tweaks these days, trying to make things work. So, one thing I wanted to get to was my favorite webpage on Wikipedia is called The List of Unsolved Problems in Physics. And I remember, for example, reading something a year and a half ago where on that page, they talked about the space roar. Space makes a noise, and they calculated how much the noise should be, and it was 6 times higher than they calculated, and how come? And when I talked about spring and loop theory originally, I made the point that this is what happens with physics, is they do calculations and things don't work out. Anyway, in the past couple of weeks, I went through that entire web page. I originally thought there was some 148 questions or something, and it turned out there were 222 questions. I went through and I endeavored to answer every one. I think I made it entertaining because, frankly, some of the questions are so ridiculous that the only appropriate answer is some humor. But what was so interesting was how many of the questions, and this actually honestly surprised me. I went in, you know, sort of legitimately wanting to explain most of these unsolved questions. I think I did. But what's interesting is that of these 222 questions, at some point I'm going to go through what I've, you know, my answers and count up how many of these questions are questions related to a theory that's failing. In other words, when Newton was looking at that apple and going, why does the apple fall to the earth? There was no theory before him. He came up with gravity. He came up with calculus. Imagine that. Newton invented calculus to help him solve his physics problems. Newton was truly a giant. If anyone can be considered a giant of science, in my opinion, it's definitely Newton. And we still use his formula 500 years later. It's pretty amazing. Anyway, he solved a problem. when Galileo looked, you know, invented, or I don't even know if he invented a telescope, honestly, but when he turned it to the heavens and looked at Jupiter and found the four moons, and then he realized, whoa, those moons are going around that planet, and then he started the whole orbital mechanics thing. Instead of us thinking the Earth was the center, we realized the Sun was the center and all that. Well, that whole, you know, sort of revolution happened. All of it was a better explanation of life, a better theory, a better understanding. Well, when was the last time we had a better theory, a better explanation of something? I'll tell you, it's been a supremely long time, like 40 or 50 years. I'm thinking back to quarks, when they realized that protons and neutrons were made of quarks. You know, that was like, okay, there is something smaller than a proton or a neutron in the nucleus, and okay, those are the things that hold it together. And then we started particle smashing. And we really haven't, you know, for 50, 60, whatever years it is, we've been smashing particles. And that is finite. You can only go so far with that. And the amount of money you have to spend, you know, it quickly gets into the tens of billions. Probably the LHC, my estimate, is going to be about $100 billion. What could you do with $100 billion? I worked on the Canadian Automated Air Traffic System, CATS, and the Military Automated Air Traffic System. I worked on the military version, doing simulations for some of the equipment. And I think the entire budget for this, what it was, is they were upgrading the air traffic control equipment of 50 airports in Canada. And you have to understand what they were going from. This is only, what, 15 years ago. They were going from paper, strips of paper, to a computer system. They just hung on to these pieces of paper. Each piece of paper is a plane. I don't even know. There could be countries in the world where they're still using this system. And they stack up these pieces of paper, these strips of paper, on their little clipboard, you could say. They do have a monitor, and I think that's for radar. You know, it shows everything in the sky, like a picture, you could say, of the sky through radar. And that's the system. Anyway, we were trying to come up with something better. And the entire budget for that whole system, this was hundreds of people working for 10 years, or 5 years anyway. All the equipment, all the buildings, all the, you know, the equipment that's going to be bought, installed. This was with Raytheon, Hughes Aircraft, which became Raytheon at that time. And the budget was like $500 million. So this was like 5 years' work for 500 people, roughly, was $500 million. So say 1 year for 500 people is $100 million. So for five people would be $1 million. Yeah, so $200,000 a person, roughly. And, of course, the person gets paid 50, and so the system, the over, you know, 25%, and the overhead is 75%. You know, it, rule of thumb, it's about right. Okay, so that whole system for 5 years was $500 million. The LHC is $5 billion a year. So it's 10 times bigger. And what happened was they fire up the LHC, and almost immediately they have a problem, and things melt down or break or sproing or whatever. I mean, seriously, the forces involved are so enormous. They were saying it's like freight trains, the energy of freight trains colliding kind of thing. It's a gargantuan apparatus, a huge ring, you know, 20 miles across, whatever it is, and they fire protons at each other and smash, you know, gold atoms together. And then they study the sparks that come off it. It is as simple as that. And they got a detector that's like 60 feet high or 100 feet high, twice as tall as a school building, just to give you an idea. This massive detector, and they're just studying sparks. It's just two kids, you know, a kid hitting two rocks together, or two hunks of metal together, and studying the sparks. That's what physics is today. This result, this last week, this first direct evidence for cosmic inflation, cosmic microwave background, blah, 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 gravity waves, all of that, yada, yada. They're studying, I looked at one of the pictures, and honestly, if that's your data, you have no data. That was my thought. It looked like if you threw like 10 rocks in a pond, the ripples that you got off it. That's what it looked like. It looked like 10 ripples. That was the picture. I remember someone showing a picture of Pluto, and it was like they had a 4-pixel picture of Pluto. I mean, to give you an idea, your screen is, let's say, 3,000 pixels. So if you get really close to your screen and you're nearsighted like I am, you can see the individual pixels. I'm going to look at the comma, or the period here, on my display. And I would say that the period is about a 9 by 9. So they had a picture of Pluto that was half the size of the period showing on your computer screen. That was the data they had for Pluto. And they talked about this, and they looked at it, and this is what happens when you keep pushing the same system and you don't innovate, and you obviously trample on innovators. People try and come up with physics theories all the time, and, you know, sure, most of them are nonsense, but the system is intolerant of it. The system doesn't go, you know, most of what you're saying is nonsense, but I'm going to give you this one point here, or, you know, here's the exact flaw. physics is not innovating. And, you know, it's actually really true of life, right? You could study any part of life and it's not innovating. And what's going on there? There's a rule of thumb that says follow the money. Well, the money in this case is when people are entrenched, when people establish something and it benefits them, when a system benefits one group, then they don't want to change the system. And so they've done some things over the years that are very carefully designed to make things, you know, worse for humans and better for them. The education system continues to get worse and worse. I've noticed a trend when I ask kids about schoolwork. I get them telling me things like, well, we watched a movie, or I was asking someone about a science class, chemistry class, and they said, well, we learned about global warming, the ozone layer. And there is a slight amount of chemistry in the ozone layer, but he hadn't learned that. He was learning basically, you know, biology in chemistry, but no one was the wiser. Why is the chemistry teacher teaching biology? Well, someone's pushing their agenda down to the classroom level. Teachers are nothing if not gullible. Partly it comes under the guise of if you want to appeal to someone and control them, then you flatter them. And, you know, teachers, there's a lot of flattery, you know, sort of self-flattery behind teaching. You know, when you're in that position of power and these little kids come in and you teach them, you know, their times tables, if you're not careful, that goes to your head. And so then things can be slipped by you and you're like, yeah, of course. For example, fluoride. Fluoride is, you know, is given to kids through the school system. They hand out fluoride pills. Can you imagine? It might take a while, but at some point in the future, we're going to realize that those Romans drinking out of lead goblets was nothing compared to us handing out fluoride pills. Nothing. The Romans, you know, the lead tasted sweet, and I think it had some other property that was useful, whether, you know, bacteria killing or something. It can be justified through a combination of ignorance, and it had some utility to them. Yeah, it had a downside, but it had some utility. Fluoride has no utility. You cannot justify it on grounds that, well, we don't know. We absolutely know. The only people who don't know are the people that are giving it out. We have, you know, frontline soldiers in the war against humans. And those frontline soldiers are teachers. The school system. The school nurse. Boy, if there's ever something I have a lack of respect for, it's a school nurse. So, in answering these questions on physics and thinking about physics and that, you know, it's at once very rewarding to come up with a better theory. Simple and better. And then, you know, it's also tiresome, we'll say, to realize that physics is not changing and no one has the will to change. If you can prove me wrong, please do so. If you know someone somewhere in the physics world that is actually open to a better theory, I'd like to hear about it. You know, there are some hucksters, there are some guys that are slick, you know, sort of Bill Nye the Science Guy kind of, you know, Mythbusters type people. They found a way to market themselves and appeal to kids. But I'm talking beyond that. I'm talking, is there someone that, the closest I can think of is Lee Smolin, S-M-O-L-I-N, Smolin. There's a guy that to me has really thought about it and has really, in a nice way, critiqued the working theories and tried to come up with something better. For me, anyway, reading his book, Three Roads to Quantum Gravity, that's when I really realized that string theory was completely dead and buried. For years, I tried to understand it, like everybody. And then I came up, you know, with my own theory, and then it sort of coexisted with string theory. And then I realized that string theory was just complete garbage. And Smolin sort of explained why. And it came down to, it's like in Einstein's relativity world, I'm gonna get off track here if I'm not careful, but one theory will assume one thing, and then the next theory will assume something different. It was like the difference between relativity and quantum mechanics is how they think of the background. But Smolin was saying that when they discovered quarks 50 years ago, two theories sort of sprung from that. One became string theory, and the other became, I think, loop quantum gravity. And it came down to, did you think it was the connectors or the particles? I think that's the essence of it. And that's sort of the irony, is that theories can live or die on the tiniest little assumptions. The tiniest ones. Einstein, I was reading in the library, a local library did a cool thing. They had a display of physics books. Normally the physics books, you know, they're sort of hidden away in their usual spot in the shelves. And I go in and yesterday, and there's a big display of them. Right when you come in the door, there's a, when I say big, I don't want to exaggerate, but in the place where they do feature things, they were featuring physics books. Caught my eye. Go over there. Wow, there's a whole bunch. Wow, there's even a shelf underneath with even more. It's like, wow, they're expecting a real demand for these things. Then I saw a little sign which said, for those people who are enjoying the Cosmos series on TV, you might enjoy these books. Anyway, I went through them, and I was on my skateboard, and remind me in the future, I'm going to talk about my skateboard. I've got a skateboard now, a longboard. So this is me at 56 and a half years of age, and I bought a longboard. Apparently, I do have a death wish. Not really. You know, honestly, it's not much different than a bicycle, as it turns out. It's a little challenging, and it's more challenging than a bicycle, yes. But, I mean, in terms of the real danger, which is, you know, cars. A scooter, a rollerblades, a skateboard, or a bicycle are all the same. They're all not as deadly as a car. So in a collision with a car, the car wins. Anyway, so I was at the library, and looking at these books, and so I was limited of how much could I carry in my little bag while I'm skateboarding. And I also had some other books. I was picking up some kids' books for someone. And so I was going to have a big bag full as it was. And I'm just here to say that it's not all that much fun to carry a large, heavy weight while you're on a skateboard. It's challenging. So I was trying to minimize the number of physics books I was going to pick up, because some of these were, you know, you don't normally see them on our shelves. And the problem is with the library system is they have truly gargantuan amount of stuff that your local library is like, it'd be like studying, you know, the moon while you look through a keyhole. Poke a hole in paper with a pencil, and then you look through this hole in the paper, and you're looking at the moon. In other words, you have to sort of scroll that hole across the sky to see the moon, right? What I'm getting at is that the actual books at your local library is, there's probably 100 times and maybe 1,000 times as many books in the system as you can see at your local library. So, anyway, they had assembled a bunch of physics books, more than I normally saw. I went through them. One of the things I read, one of the books which I ended up not bringing home, because I think it was Freeman Dyson, and there wasn't a lot of physics in it, but one of the things that was interesting was he just talked briefly about Henri Poincaré and Einstein. Just before Einstein came out with relativity, what was going on? And Freeman Dyson's thesis of this book was, his theory of this book was that you had to be a bit of a risk taker to get your theory out there. And, you know, and there's a lot of truth in that, isn't there? You got to be a risk taker. You got to, and I feel I've been a risk taker with my own theory. And let me tell you, you don't make any money off coming up with a new theory of physics. It's a thankless job. It's like when you come out against fluoride, it's a thankless job, and you're not going to make any money off that. The people that make money these days are the people doing the wrong thing. People doing the right thing are not making money. And I think it's going to always be that way. It's sort of your clue, right? If people are making money, they're doing the wrong thing. A few exceptions. I'll say Costco's an exception. Costco makes money, and yet Costco's doing the right thing. And there's a servicer to mankind, and I'm really quite proud of Costco. Or Pete's, for that matter. You know, Pete's mantra is quality first, foremost, and always. The Starbucks phenomenon is a group that, they took good coffee to the world, and in so doing, in my opinion, it's become horrible coffee, because the system to make money is totally different than the system to make good coffee. And Pete's just refused to compromise. Costco doesn't compromise. You should watch, there was a documentary on Costco, I think it's called The Costco Craze, I think it was on CNBC. Really, really awesome. These guys are legit to the core. Anyway, so this guy was talking about Poincaré and Einstein 100 years ago, and what he was saying was really kind of interesting. He said that 100 years ago, Poincaré was the dude. He was the man. This has been what I figured out just on my own, was that when I have done my research on the history of theories, it's obvious that Poincaré was working on relativity at the same time as Einstein. And they literally both came out with their theories at the same time. And Freeman Dyson's thesis, his theory of his book, was that, you know, Einstein took more risks. But guess what? Dyson was saying that Poincaré did not succeed because Poincaré was too cautious and he was entertaining thoughts of the ether. Well, I came out with Cosalt 4 about the ether, a talk strictly about the ether and how I say we need it. It's there and we need it, and I'm absolutely certain of this. Well, I wasn't the only one. Not only did Poincaré think there was an ether, and Einstein at one point, but Maxwell, James Clerk Maxwell, the Maxwell equations, this is the guy that linked electricity and magnetism. This was the first integration, the first big unification of relatively modern physics. Well, he was a big ether fan. I'm pretty sure Isaac Newton was. Many, many people have been ether fans, and it's absolutely essential, and it's obvious that it's there. What's embarrassing is we supposedly looked for it, we didn't find it, and then we said it doesn't exist. Now, by that measure, there would be no religion. We supposedly looked for it. We didn't find it. You can't find proof of it. Then it doesn't exist. Now, yeah, on an individual basis, that might be true, but collectively, it's not true. Collectively, even scientists talk religion. The God particle and, the Big Bang Theory, for that matter, is very religious. Movies today have religion almost invariably in them somewhere. Someone's being buried and it's in a cemetery, and that's all. There's all religious overtones to that. The point is that you can't prove a negative. Just because you don't find an ether doesn't mean it's not there. Especially when I think it's there. So Einstein dropped the ether, and I had found this just probably a month ago when I was reading Quantum Physics for Poets. This is a book trying... This is what happens when physics is in the doldrums. People come up with gimmicks. Brief history of time. Gimmick. There's been a bunch of books on time in the last year or two. It's a gimmick. It's so non-mainstream. They can't solve gravity, so they have to work on all this other nonsense. So this book, Quantum Physics for Poets, the title intrigued me. Well, hey, that's why they chose that title, right? Okay, in that book, at the most, there's about, let's say, 20 poems. I don't like poetry, I never have. I don't see the point of it, I don't get it. I deliberately avoided every single one of those poems. I just simply didn't read them. They were, you know, typical stuff, whoever writes poetry. I'm going to say Yeats, I could be way off the mark, but it had no relevance at all to the physics in the book. It was like having a book on physics and then talking about your 1968 Mustang convertible. And just like randomly talking about, oh yeah, I like the bucket seats. And then like going on with your physics. And yeah, it's got a 289 engine. I really like that engine. The four-barrel carburetor really throws you back in your seat. And then, you know, talking physics and, oh yeah, that stick shift. It was that strange. But that's where we're at. That's what people are doing. We're in the age of gimmick physics. And I challenge anyone, send me something that proves me wrong. Send me something that shows that people are actually innovating, other than myself. This can come across as arrogance, me being arrogant. And that's fine. The reason I say it's fine is there's nothing I can do about it. If you think I'm arrogant, well, so be it. I'm not trying to be. I'm trying to provide a theory, a working theory. A theory that doesn't need tweaks. The day of their announcement, this announcement last week, the day of the announcement, they were announcing tweaks. And 1 week later, the more cooler heads were going, I don't know. What was it, horrendously ugly? When a guy being interviewed by a physics website says something is horrendously ugly, that's your clue that it's a bunch of bollocks, as the British would say. That's where we're at. Physics today, the new physics, is a bunch of bollocks. Old wine, new bottles. So, I didn't think I was going to talk quite that long about it, and I certainly didn't want to start off with, it's basically a negative, but you can't get away from it. The thing is, when you follow the thread of things, everything bad in our life that's happening is, it's from something negative at the starting point. What's happening that's bad economically, I just see it all over where people don't have jobs, and they had two incomes, now they have one, and there's just countless examples of this. Well, if you trace it all back, it goes back to the Federal Reserve. They cornered the money market. It used to be that a government could print its own money. You know, Lincoln was assassinated because of Lincoln greenbacks. Look at the greenbacks. Lincoln wanted money to have a basis, and the people that control us, they didn't want that because there's no profit in that. When something has a basis, you can't exaggerate it, you can't stretch it. Well, it's the same with physics. When physics has a basis, if someone ever comes up with a simple explanation of physics, and yes, I think my theory qualifies, you won't be able to go lower than that. You won't be able to go simpler than that. And you will build your house, you'll build your explanation, sort of like what Newton did. And then Newton's theory reigned for 400 years because it was basic. Chemistry has a basic structure. Unlike physics, chemistry has a basic low-level structure and understanding. And as a result, we have created 10 million chemical compounds, and there just isn't controversy, and it just works. When you build a building, when you build a bridge, you look at modern bridges, how many of them look the same? That structure with the two tall towers, and they have the cables coming from the tower. Individual cables, not just like a strand, not like a loop of cable, one loop across the whole thing like the Golden Gate. But now they have these a fan shape of cables from each tower. You know, well, why is that happening? Because that's the best structure. That is the cheapest way to build a bridge. And now everyone's doing it. They're all over the place. I can just think of countless examples of these. And it's the way it has to be if you want to do something economical. Well, chemistry's been reduced to the simplest form, and it doesn't change, and it just gets better. It just builds on something positive. We need that in our physics. We need that in our financial system. Our financial system will only get horrendously worse all the time, rapidly, by the way. It's going to be speeding up because there isn't a basis to the money. Same with health. There isn't a basis to our health. We talk health and we talk diet, and it's all the time, and everyone thinks they're an expert. But we still eat meat. The majority of people eat meat. It's like the fluoride. I care for people, and some of those people, they, you know, to watch them putting that toothpaste, that fluoridated toothpaste in their mouth is hard. Some of them take fluoride supplements. Watching that, that's hard. You know with absolute certainty that it's a bad thing. And these sweet young kids are typically doing it willingly, eagerly to themselves because the adults have told them it's okay. Where's our ethics in this culture? Where's our, like I say in one of my talks, you know, modern physics truly has no shame. The Cosmos series, wow, what was that unwatchable? It's creepy. It's really creepy. It sort of reminds me of Howard Cosell. Howard Cosell was creepy. He was a guy that could make you hate football, and that's not easy. What was going on there? He was a lawyer. I believe he was a lawyer. How did a lawyer ever get involved in football? You know, when you investigate things, there's often a creepy underbelly. Oh, bad driver of the month. I was trying to introduce that concept last week as something humorous. I saw a few bad drivers, but I've decided to nominate myself or something I did as the bad driver of the week award. I was going to my usual shopping place, and I'm in the turn lane, and the light turns green, and I was a little slow getting going. When I say a little slow, literally like 1 or 2 seconds. And the light, as I'm going through the intersection, immediately turned yellow and then red. But that turn lane had like 10 cars in it or 8 cars in it. Why did it do that? Anyway, so I was the bad driver that I, by taking literally 2 seconds longer than normal, caused the ones behind me to have to wait for the next light, frustrating them. But why did that light do that? You know, modern lights, well, it's kind of like modern physics. You know, there are some lights that are just completely dumb. They go on a cycle. They change back and forth. You know, these guys get a green, then those guys get a green. And there are probably not too many of those lights left. Oh, I shouldn't say that. I've seen them. And where I live, there are some parts of the city old. They feel like older parts of the city. The roads are older, and it's more of that grid. When you get into the grid of a modern city, you get old because the new way is to have these bypass roads, these roads that perimeter roads, the roads that go around the outside of the city. When you want to get from A to B, you hop on these highways that go around the city, and that's smart. As John Nesbitt of Megatrends talked about bypassing. This is a book of 40 years ago that was kind of groundbreaking for its time. And the reason it was groundbreaking is that John Nesbitt was groundbreaking. His company, his method was pretty cool. So John Nesbitt's Megatrends was a great book because he came up with 10 theories, 10 trends, and the book was just a smash hit. But what was interesting was what was behind it. His company, what they did was they researched, or they recorded, you might say, what was actually happening. In other words, rather than theorizing, you know, books try and theorize and try and predict the future, it's very tough to do. It's basically because some guy sits in a room by himself and thinks, what's the future going to be like, and tries to come up with something. But the reality is what's happening today. So if you look at trends today, that will tell you what the future is going to be like. The obvious trend today is, you know, it's negative on all fronts because they've got now the level of control that they've been looking for, number one. Number two, they have the technological backing. The computer systems have developed to the point where they're good enough for them to do what they want, to control us like never before. I mean, cameras in a public place have been around a long time. But when that camera records to a tape, a VHS tape, in the back room, and you need a physical recording device, that's one level of technology. But when you can record it to a little camera that's smaller than a dime, and it can be invisible, and it's all digital, the video is digitally converted, and you put it onto a big, huge hard drive somewhere, you can have, you know, 100 times as many cameras. In England, they got something, it's in the millions. I was going to say 3 million, but it could be 5 million, it doesn't really matter. It's in the millions. They only have 60 million people there. So they have one camera for every 50 people, and that's public cameras recording everything going by. If 10,000 cars go by that street, 10,000 cars are being recorded on one camera per day. In and of itself, each one of these cameras is nothing, but the system is something. Well, that's a trend that's going to continue in the future. You can safely say that. So that's what Nesbitt did. His thing was for newspapers, publications, and he went through them and he analyzed what were they talking about. And then he compiled his trends from that. So, bypassing. So some lights are old school. They're on a fixed frequency, like they've been for 50 years. the more modern light, they have detectors which detect, is there somebody waiting on the smaller road? There's always like a main road and a side road, right? Is there someone on the side road wanting to get into traffic? If the system detects a car, then it changes the light. And that's great. They do that by cut into the road with like a saw. There are special, you can get saws, they're like a chainsaw, but they have a blade, like a saw blade, like a skill saw blade. And you can cut into pretty much anything these days. And so they cut into the road, just a sort of a straight line, and then they put the wire in there, and then they fill it with tar. And that's, of course, a weak link in itself. And that's why when it rains, there'll be some traffic lights that change as if there was a car there, and there's no car there. And what's even more annoying is not only do they change, but they then act like there are 10 cars on the side road. In other words, the light will stay on the longest. On a dry day, one car triggers the light. As soon as the car leaves the side road onto the main road, the light immediately turns back to green for the main flow of traffic. But in the rain, there'll be no sidecars, and that light will stay red against the main flow for, it seems like, a long time. And it is. It's 20 seconds or whatever it might be. And that's because of the water getting into the slit that has been cut in the road where the wire was put in. And now the wire is corroded, and it's giving a false reading. Anyway, the point is that those detectors allowed traffic lights to be more fair and to not senselessly go back and forth to red and green forever, all day, every day. And that was a good thing. When they first did them, they had a single sensor right at the intersection. In other words, when the first car pulled up, the first car would be sitting on that little ring, that little circle of the sensor. Well, people would pull up and they'd be 5 feet away from the intersection, and they wouldn't be on that little ring, that little detector, and the light would never turn. And then you'd come along behind them, and next thing you know, you're tearing your hair off because you've been there for 2 minutes, and the light's not turning. So then if you look on roads now, you'll see, you'll have two detectors back to back. They'll have a bigger landing zone. So even the morons, the drivers who are not aware of how the system works, will land on the detector. Well, the next level beyond that is they'll have detectors maybe 5 cars back. And I don't know how they use their system, but I know how I would use that information. That detector 5 cars back can count the number of cars in that lane. The detector that's at the intersection itself can only tell there's a car. If there's 2, it doesn't know. If there's 10, it doesn't know. Well, the system is going to behave differently if there's 10 than if there's 2. These lights are highly synchronized nowadays, even though they don't seem like they are. The reason they don't seem like they are is you're speeding. Stop it. They're designed so that you can only synchronize one way. They can rush hour. The morning, you know, rush hour people have the perception of rush hour that traffic's horrible. Well, it's not necessarily the case. Depends on your city and which roads you're driving on. But luckily where I live, most of the roads when you're driving during rush hour, you travel almost as fast as at any other time. And the reason is that, yes, there are more cars, but they set up the lights for the major flow of traffic. Whereas when it's not rush hour, they deliberately shaft you. They deliberately make the lights non-synchronized. It's really interesting. Just think about that and why they would do that. I'll leave that as a future puzzle. Maybe I'll get back to it. Hang on, I need to hydrate. That's another sip for my cup of quality. So when you have a second detector, much further, multiple cars behind the first one, now you can tell how many cars are in that lane. And that gives you a clue of how long you need the side road light to be green. And then that tells you when you need to trigger it to become green. In other words, it allows a finer level of control of the system and a better system, a more fair system. Because sometimes what you get on the side roads is, the light would turn green for the side traffic, and then 2 cars go through and the light would turn red again. Well, now, and again, where I live, with, I think fairly state-of-the-art lights for the main roads, the side road will be green if there's 8 cars, at least 7 of those cars, and often 8, will get through the intersection before the light turns back to red for the side traffic again. And that's nice. It means if you're waiting on the side road, you only wait one light. It means there's no backup of cars. And, of course, when there's only one car, then the light quickly turns green for the main flow after that one car is cleared. The system is pretty much ideal. But they don't have that system everywhere. There are some egregious examples, some bad intersections that, in the one that I embarrass myself on, it's a very busy intersection. It is a 50 mile an hour flow of traffic on top of another 50 going the other way. We're just 1/5 of a mile away from another major highway. It's a huge interchange. And one of the two main lights at this huge interchange. And the turn lane is very long. It's well designed. You can pack a lot of cars in there. And when it turned green, it detected a little gap and it went, oh, forget it. And it went back to red again, where it knew by the other detectors in that lane, it knew there were other cars. It knew how many cars were in that lane, but it had a hair trigger. And there's another light closer to where I live, and it's a little side road, and it's kind of a not the greatest intersection, honestly, because it always favors one direction, even when there's no traffic. Those are really annoying situations. So what happens is one's direction gets the light first, they get the left turn, and then your way, the sort of the lesser way, may or may not get the light at all. So it's good if there's no cars in the direction I'm always going, but it's bad if there are cars and there's no cars the other way, that they get a green and there's no cars there, and you have to wait, count to 10, and then now you get your green. Anyway, the good thing about this light is it does know how many cars are in the turn lanes, and it'll stay green a surprisingly long time, and all the cars will clear. Anyway, so for some reason in this major interchange, the left turn lane has a hair trigger. So what happened was it was me making sort of an absent-minded move, and then this hair trigger light making me the bad driver of the week. So that's my bad driver of the week story. Went a long way in for that one, didn't I? But mea culpa, it's my fault, and I'll take the hit, I'll take the blame. Doesn't happen often. And you know, part of us getting better is we got to be humble. We got to take the blame when we're wrong on something. We have to do that readily and quickly, and we certainly have to do it to ourselves. We may not want to admit it to others, but when we do something wrong, we have to admit it to ourselves. If we don't, we are now lying to ourselves. As soon as we start doing that, our quality of life goes straight down the tubes. And of course, it impacts others. But the worst thing of all is we start to become confused. We confuse ourselves. And when you are self-confused, when you have confused yourself, you're in for a long test. You look at someone who drinks alcohol. It all started with them confusing themselves. Okay, it can be ignorance at first. You know, they take their first sips or drinks when they don't know. If you grow up with parents that are alcoholics, I've known a couple of people where their parents were alcoholics. They're indoctrinated into alcohol. They're going to grow up with alcohol, and they're going to be alcoholics in many cases because they've grown up with that system. Same with smoking. But for most of us, we have some degree of knowledge. But if we kid ourselves, if we minimize, like you'll read things that say, you know, one cup of wine a day is good for you, you know, and blah, blah, blah. These confusing and lying messages are put out there because they know that in many cases that's all it'll take for someone to drink, is that someone said once in a study, made up study 26 years ago on a Tuesday, you know, they said, it's good for you and it puts hair in your chest, and so they start drinking. Don't let that level of confusion happen. Question your own motives. Question what you're doing. And notice your feedback. If you start waking up in the morning, you're like, wow, I feel terrible. Well, do you think it has anything to do with the 6 beers you had last night when you're watching a football game? Put it together. You can do your own little test on fluoride. You can get it out of your diet and out of your toothpaste and all the different things, and you can see what the effect is. Just bear in mind that when your body is recovering, it will go through the same symptoms as the original problem. It's called a healing crisis. I think it's something that, hang on a second. Healing crisis is when your body, when we get sick, our body is humming along, everything's fine, and then something weighs us down. Something bogs us down. It's like truck driving through the mud. And driving through that mud, it starts flicking up dirt, the engine overheats, and the truck stalls. That's a cold. When you get the truck going again, the truck is not the same as it was. Overheating a truck is serious. The engine oil is now dirty. The air filter is, you know, clogged up. And engines break down from being overworked. And it shows in the life of the truck. Well, trucks don't self-heal. Mechanical things don't do that. But humans can. And if you do everything right, you can reverse what just happened. It's like literally you can play the film backward and that truck can drive through that mud in reverse and come out of it clean and pristine and better than when it went in. We can do that with our bodies. But to do it, we have to go through the mud in reverse. What that means is when something makes us sick, it drags us down. When we do everything right and we house clean, and that's what good living is. Good living is house cleaning. We clean our house. We take Senna for our elimination. We exercise, which helps us eliminate. We drink water, which helps us eliminate. We're careful what poisons we put into us, which reduces what we have to eliminate. When we do everything right, our body gets caught up, and it's like, hey, I'm all caught up in things. If you don't mind, I'm going to do some extra house cleaning, and I'm going to clean out your lymph nodes. And then you're like, oh, I feel my throat. Normally, when you feel your throat, you're getting a cold. but when you go through a healing crisis, you're going to feel your throat just briefly, not as long, not as severely, and without the debilitating symptoms. You're just going to feel that area, and that's because your body is working on that area. It's just doing a little house cleaning. The healing crisis is an interesting thing. I really should return to that in the future. All right, well, on that slightly anticlimactic note, I'm just going to close up by saying that I think the latest revelations about the cosmic microwave background and inflation and gravity waves, I think it's all bogus. Those theories have flaws, and just because you supposedly detect something does not mean you've gotten around the flaws. The inflation thing is particularly egregious, a particularly ugly hack, maybe the worst hack in physics. I invite you to listen to my own talk. I call it COSOL Takes on the Wikipedia List of Unsolved Problems in Physics. It's also called 222 Answers. So if you type in COSALT, COASALT, 222 Answers into YouTube, it'll bring it right up. I think it's kind of an enjoyable talk. It's long. It's 80 minutes long. It's thorough. 222 different answers or comments. And you'll start to realize that physics is, these days, is Swiss cheese. It's embarrassing. It's like modern movies are embarrassing. When you study movies, you realize there's almost no movies worth watching. It's so close to zero, it's not funny. I don't know how people do it. I don't know how people watch movies these days. I think they do it just sort of out of habit, and they're bored. It's Friday night, and hey, honey, I rented, you know, and then they watch a movie. Have a higher standard than that. What I do is, it's not like I don't, you know, check out movies from the library. It's that I can't watch them. I'll watch a minute, 5 minutes, 10 minutes, 20 minutes. And for most movies, they won't survive. I will stop watching them. Develop that critical ability to stop watching, to stop doing something that doesn't make sense. Oh, that's what I was talking about, is confusing yourself. Healing crisis, yeah. When you do things right, you will improve your body's health. But if you had a health illness recently, you will go back through that again. And you'll have some of the symptoms, but you know, if that cold lasted 2 weeks before, when you go through the healing crisis, it'll last a day and a half. And at the end of it, you'll have more energy, not less. So try it. Try getting those bad things out of your life, especially try and get microwaves out of your life. For the last couple of weeks, I've tried to resist talking about microwaves. And it's not because there hasn't been things happening on that front. Really, if anything, it's the opposite. The number of microwave devices that are coming out is exploding. It really is. Let me just see if I can bring up. I was looking at my notes here. They've got a smart pen now. A smart pen. Do you need a smart pen? They got Wi-Fi connected air conditioner. Why does your air conditioner need to be connected to Wi-Fi? Now, in theory, there is some value of having your central thermostat Wi-Fi enabled so that, in theory, you could set the temperature of your house. Let's say you have the temperature low, and then half an hour before you come home, you could, you know, log into your house via the internet, and you could set your thermostat higher, in theory. In reality, you can also do it on a timer. They've been programmable for I don't know how many years, and you could just program the whole thing. The thermostat I can see. Why does your air conditioner itself need Wi-Fi? But by no means is this the limit. Zip your Wi-Fi in crowded buildings. This isn't one of the next levels of Wi-Fi, is to get it down to the more human level, the closer level. You're going to have Wi-Fi hotspots. And there was even an ad I saw yesterday for, I think it was AT&T, and it showed two guys in the sub-ceiling of an office. And what are you doing in there? Oh, we're making your Wi-Fi even better. See, the whole thing with Wi-Fi is it started off as a broadcast, kind of like the early days of radio. It was a broadcast, right? A big antenna and a broadcast. And then TV was a broadcast. And then TV became cable. And cable went to your house. And it was better, assuming TV is good, which is a bad assumption. But it was a better broadcast, let's put it that way. And now, with the internet and Netflix, it's very precise, right? If you want a movie, you can turn on a movie. If you don't want it, you can turn it off. And you can have it on demand. And on demand is like one stage better. Well, they're going to do this with Wi-Fi, with wireless, with microwave radiation. That they started off with massive towers blasting us and killing the people closest to the tower. And that has its inherent problems. You know, the energy drops off as the cube of the distance from the antenna. So if you have a microwave source a block away, you're probably getting an unhealthy level, to put it mildly, one block away. Well, if you go two blocks away, it's eight times less. It's probably still unhealthy, but it's eight times less. And if you go three, it's 27 times less, yeah. So, you know, if you get four blocks away from that cell phone tower, you're probably okay. You still probably want to do some mitigation measures, but it's not as hard to get your levels down. So to get coverage, that's why they are putting smart meters on people's houses. That's why there's going to be all these other various technologies. Now, it's going to be under the guise, the profit for them is going to be that they can get you a faster signal to you, wherever you are. But to do that, they're going to have to get these little cell phone towers, mini towers, let's call them, everywhere. And smart appliances are the thin edge of that ugly wedge. And anyway, this stuff is carrying on. Wi-Fi doorbells, I'm looking at my notes here. Voice control of your Nest thermostat. When you hear Nest, you're talking Wi-Fi radiation. Don't kid yourself. Here's a story. The headline of the story was, don't panic, but that public Wi-Fi is coming from inside your house. Comcast, of course, slipped Wi-Fi into their routers. They offered free upgrades of their modems. To connect to Comcast, you need a modem. But then within your home, you typically bought your own router. A router allows multiple devices to connect to one connection. Well, Comcast went and offered this, sent out an email, and made an announcement like, hey, we're upgrading your services for free. Contact us. And it was like, fill out this paperwork and we'll send you this new device, which is now a combination of the old modem and a router built in. And I was like, huh, can't go wrong. They were even saying you don't even have to take the old equipment back to Comcast. It's truly a free upgrade. Well, you don't find money in the ground. Companies don't do this for no reason. Why were they doing this? They were sending that because, and I only found this out sort of as the device was on its way to me, I learned through the media that the new router has wireless built in. So the old modem was just a cable-based, a connection, a wired connection-based system. No radiation, essentially none, from my books anyway. The kind that I'm most worried about is none. The new one, by default, when you plug it in, it's broadcasting wirelessly. Very bad news. So I contacted them and I was like, can you turn it off? I never got a straight answer. One person at Comcast literally hung up on me. Why would they do that? And it turned out, Slashdot talked about this, I wasn't the only one they were doing this to. You know, people weren't getting a straight answer. Well, what was going on? Why was it Wi-Fi? Comcast has come up with a thing where, using this now wireless ability, yes, they offer you, the guy inside your house, wireless for free with their new upgraded product. And they, through complex, you know, design and programming, they can offer wireless to people walking by outside your house. Now, it's not piggybacking directly on your wireless. You're not losing, in theory, anything. They've split the bandwidth between the two services there. But the public one is available if you are a Comcast user subscriber. You can log in. And so wherever you go, you can get Comcast service. And apparently there's a database. Let's see, it's called hotspots.wifi.comcast.com. And there's over a million of these hotspots so far. That's wireless radiation coming down to your level, to your house level, with a free product. You didn't even have to pay for it. If you're a fan of wireless, these are glory days. I'm not. And as I say, I don't want to pound it into my listeners, but microwave hell is coming. It's hitting our shores right now. The companies, the big wireless companies, are currently bidding on more spectrum. More spectrum translates to higher energies, more radiation, and that's on top of what's already there. In other words, each generation is... It's like you had the slingshot, then you had the arrow, bow and arrow, then you had the gun, then you had the machine gun, and then you had the modern weapons, like the Uzi, let's say. And that progression is the rock thrower doesn't go away, the pistol doesn't go away. All the new ones are added to the old ones. All the new wireless frequencies are added to the old ones because people have old equipment and they got to keep it all running. So it's like if you had a problem at level 1, then they add 3G and now you have 4 times as much problems because you had the 1 plus you got 3 times as much radiation and 3 and 1 is 4. And then they come up with 4G and now it's like 3 times as much again, so you had 1 plus 3 plus, let's say, 6. Now you're up to 10. 10 times the problem of what it was. And this is what's happening. It is only going to get a whole heck of a lot worse. So just because I've shown restraint and not talked about it doesn't mean it isn't happening. Just read for yourself these articles and just consider just for a moment, why are they doing these things? This one cracks me up. A Wi-Fi doorbell. What does that mean? You go to someone's house and you can make their doorbell ring with Wi-Fi. I don't even understand this. Who's needing this? Maybe what it does is it replaces the doorbell so that I... I just know the product exists and it has Wi-Fi. It has microwave radiation as part of it. Yummy. All right. Well, this podcast has been a bit of a record breaker and quite rambly. I guess the biggest thing of all is I'm proud of my 222 answers and I'm proud of my theory, spring loop theory. And I'm kind of embarrassed and tired by the state of physics, the state of life. So all I can do is, you know, say my piece and move on and try and have a good day despite the kind of embarrassing state of the world, the very unenlightened state of the world today. So on that slight down note, okay, substantial down note. This has been a substantial down note. That's how I've interpreted it. I apologize for that. I'll try and do better the next time. But this has been Floyd Maxwell, justthinkit.com. Been listening to Floydcast number 6. Good luck with your life and take care. And I hope you have a good week.